And welcome back to Cambridge Inside Out, part two, here on April 16th, 2024. All right. So I've touched on a lot of sort of arguably random things in the last half hour. I thought maybe what I'd like to do next is to talk a little bit about some things that have been happening up at Cambridge City Council. And you might as well start with the potentially the most controversial of them. Okay, so some years ago, I think it might have been 2017. I could be wrong about that. The city council decided, over the objections of some city administrative people, to pass something called the Bicycle Safety Ordinance or the Cycling Safety Ordinance, or I think it's Cycling Safety Ordinance because I always get confused because that's the acronym is CSO, which is the same as Combined Sewer Overflow. So, knowing a thing or two about both, I find that very confusing. But anyway, and what it did was it actually, rather than promote city management to be strongly considering doing road designs in order to create separated bicycle facility, it mandated it. Now, in the original plan from, when it was, the ordinance was first passed, it didn't have rigid timelines baked into the cake. And there were certain streets, because I participated in the process leading up to it. There were certain streets that were not on their map of targeted streets that were going to be subjected to this treatment. But then in the midst of COVID, li literally, I think it was in April 2020, thereabouts, or soon thereafter, they came in and they passed a revision to the Cycling Safety Ordinance that not only just snuck some streets in that hadn't been in there previously, which bothered me greatly because I didn't really want to see Broadway included in there, but they just snuck it in. And of course, the councilors, being relatively clueless on such matters, didn't speak about it. And they more significantly made it everything made mandatory rigid timelines for the implementation of X number of miles per year of these so-called protected bike lanes. Now, just so you know where I stand on this, if you don't already, there are certain streets, where there is sufficient friction between, so to speak, between a bicyclist and motorized vehicles, that separation is absolutely the right thing to do. Certainly, I don't think anybody would argue that along a major highway that cyclists should just be riding in the slow lane while cars are whipping by at 55 miles an hour. In my view, riding over the Longfellow Bridge, but in particular, and actually not so much the Longfellow Bridge, but the Mass Ave Bridge, I've seen buses come within 2 inches of a cyclist where the speed differential was like 30 miles an hour. And that was just fundamentally unsafe. So there's no question that there are some places where this kind of bicycling accommodation needs to be made and has been made in many such places, including the Mass Ave Bridge. But there are a lot of other places where it's more problematic than anything else. In my view, the treatment that they did along Garden Street might have been acceptable if they just did it with the plastic posts and moving some parking, but they dropped down these heavy-duty concrete curbstones right in the middle of the way, and they narrow the street in such a way that it actually, if you're a motor vehicle operator, it actually has become pretty unsafe. And there have been crashes. There are even some places where you won't even notice that there's a concrete curb right in front of you until you're right on it, and you barely have time to react at all. So, again, maybe the problem is that the traffic engineers, if we have any traffic engineers in Cambridge, city government, aren't doing a very good job of it. But so anyway, my basic point is some of these things have been okay, some of these have been not okay, and no account was ever given to what the other impacts of the development of these bicycle separated bicycle lanes and the parking removal, what effect that might have on local businesses. And it's lovely, you know, the cycling activists, they love to quote studies in Toronto that say it always helps businesses, and that's just not true. Sometimes it does. Depends on the business, of course. Like a cafe might do okay. An appliance store might not do so okay, right? A medical establishment where people have to drive to get there, or a place that actually draws people from you know, distant locations, they're not going to do so well, you know. Anyway, I am of the opinion that the cycling safety ordinance, the revised version from 2020, needs some repair, bicycle repair. And a lot of people know this. It's clear, it's obvious, really. Yet it's become a political third rail. You can't touch it because the cycling activists, they come running up and turn it into a great cause. They pack the city council meetings with not only written communications, but people who sign up for public comment. It's a very, very well orchestrated political campaign every single time. That said, there appears to be, in my view, four city councilors who would like to revise this. You know, so specifically, if I get them right, I think the mayor, Denise Simmons, Paul Toner, Joan Pickett, and Aisha Wilson. Aisha Wilson, for a number of reasons, and again, I have no desire to speak for her here, but there are some people in some parts of the city who are really serious working people who kind of need that parking, and they are, you know, or they have families and they have to be able to move children around and take them to schools and daycares, whatever. And it's more than an inconvenience. It's an absolute nightmare for some of them. So therefore, at least who want to change things. I think whether it be for purely political reasons or ideological reasons, in my estimation, you can count Siddiqui, McGovern, Azeem, and Sabrina Wheeler amongst the four who probably, as I say, for whatever their reasons, don't want to touch this thing. After all, we signed the pledge, thou shalt not touch that third rail. And that puts our good little friend, Patricia Nolan, smack dab in the middle. There were a lot of people during the 2023 municipal election who had some real concerns about, you know, when the Garden Street bike lanes went in and some of the other bicycle infrastructure in the western part of the city went in, which is largely her political base, they weren't happy about it. So that put her in a kind of an awkward position. So she chose not to sign the bike pledge, but somehow miraculously got still listed on their endorsement card. So she's in this position of having to play both sides. Well, now's your opportunity to really play both sides, Councillor Nolan, you know, because there's, in my estimation at least, there's going to be sooner or later a 5-4 vote on whether to make some modifications to the cycling safety ordinance. And sad to say, the ball is going to be in the court of Councillor Nolan on this one, I'm pretty sure. So it'd be nice if some other people just sort of looked around and found some reasonable compromises. And by the way, I'm bringing this up here because the recent city council meeting, a couple of the city councilors actually did introduce an order to sort of delay some of the implementation to give some time to do some accommodation to find alternatives for parking so this did not harm businesses. There are some other good reasons for revisiting the cycling safety ordinance other than just the accommodation of parking for the sake of businesses. Even in purely residential areas, there are some really good reasons for doing so. And I'll speak as a person who lives on a street where I have a coffee shop and two daycares and on one side of the street and a public school on the other side of the street. So what are you going to do on my street? You know, you're just going to like yank away all the parking and, you know, you can't take away the school buses. So what are you going to do? Say screw you to the daycare and to the coffee shop, you know, I don't know. So anyway, in my opinion, Broadway should be taken back off. It was not on the original plan. It ought to be removed from the plan. Simple as that. At least that would make me happy. But, you know, again, the third rail is a third rail. And, you know, as they say, this is a contingent of people who, if you make even the slightest suggestion of a modification, they lose their minds. So we'll see where that all goes. So anyway, that's on us there. That's before them. So there were two orders, two city council orders. One is, and it was largely, I think both of these were largely done in cooperation with city staff. They wanted to modify the cycling safety ordinance timelines to give some time to try and tweak the parking and traffic demand management, PTDM ordinance, to allow certain things to happen that was not previously allowed to happen. For example, if I happen to have multiple parking spaces on my property, which I don't, I have zero parking spaces on my property, which is part of the reason why this concerns me, then I'm not allowed to rent them, right? It's just not allowed. It's against the PTDM ordinance. So some people do it. So in a twist that would have been unthinkable a decade ago, the city's now saying, well, maybe we ought to change that to let people rent their spaces. See, the whole idea of PTDM was to discourage people from driving into Cambridge. And if you allow people to rent spaces, you know, then you'd basically be encouraging people to drive into Cambridge. See, so they want to maybe make some tweaks to that and also give some private businesses who may have parking spaces that are available, like a parking lot that's available after hours, that might actually help accommodate some of this parking that might be lost through the development of either bicycle lanes or in some case, like on North Mass Ave and elsewhere, from dedicated bus lanes, right? So there's some scrambling going on in the form of these two ordinances. And, you know, anyway, they passed, at least to sort of go to proceed to study, I think. I think one of them may be subject to the charter right. I'm not sure. Oh, yeah, subject to the charter right. So that'll come back later this month. So anyway, you know, Cambridge civic and political life should not be dominated by bicycle lanes, but it is. And, you know, so it's going to be before us. There's just no getting around it. Now, I'll just mention a few other kind of more small changes. So I have to say the question about the modifications of the bicycle safety ordinance is probably the big one that's right before us. I mean, let me at least also mention that we did discover from December until now that Cambridge is not so wealthy that it doesn't have to worry about tax revenue and the ability to cover capital projects and even its own operating budget without the need for rather significant tax increases, which may very well be coming. So I'm only mentioning it right now just to remind everybody that once we turn the corner into the month of May in a few weeks, we will have the city's fiscal 25 budget book before us. And there will be the usual round of budget hearings conducted by the city council's finance committee. And this year might be a little bit different than past years in that it'll be done under the, you know, in an era where we actually have to think about maybe controlling some spending, which nobody's talked about for the last few years. So that should be kind of interesting. Anyway, some other things that come up, you know, and are also sort of good points of departure. So there's a city council order just the other day. I mean, maybe I won't even go to the link for it here, but where they always want to promote things like tenant protection ordinance, you know, this tenant protect new, they always want to increase tenant protections, right? Which sounds like a very good idea. The only reason I'm even mentioning that here is just to say that, speaking now as a property owner with tenants, that sometimes rattling those sabers about tenant protections actually ends up having a bit of a paradoxical effect. You know, in the absence of a lot of the sort of legislative action to basically tell landlords what they can and can't do, they do, whether intentionally or unintentionally, create a bit of a conflict between landlords and tenants, which maybe that exists naturally, you know, especially with the big landlords or whatever. But that doesn't, you know, this doesn't have to be warfare between tenants and landlords. You know, for goodness sake, in my experience, most tenants and landlords get along pretty well, you know, especially in small properties, and they work cooperatively. I've certainly tried to be that way in my house. And it's really kind of annoying when you listen to the rhetoric of city councilors who are always talking as though somehow everybody who owns property and rents apartments is basically out to screw the tenants and that they have to be protected from those evil landlords. There are some evil landlords, but most landlords, honestly, it's not true. You know, we're all in this boat together, folks. You know, so I kind of wish they would sort of dial down the rhetoric a little bit, you know, and say it's not necessary that we have to like legislate warnings to all tenants about how to screw your landlord should ever there ever be a disagreement. But that's, you know, maybe that's just part of Cambridge tradition now. Hard to say. There's another city council order came out. I think it might have been at the last meeting. I think it's really more of an endorsement of a legislative initiative. Where it's sort of like, is this the old canard from years ago about tax the churches? I even have a button called tax the churches, you know, and the fact is that churches, nonprofits, they all enjoy these sort of, they don't have to pay real estate taxes. But in a city like Cambridge, where there's a lot of nonprofits, including hospitals, universities, that's the big one for us, and other nonprofits, that means that's properties that are non-taxpayers, which moves all of the burden of tax paying onto the commercial properties and the not nonprofit part in my double negative residential property owners. You'll always hear floated this notion about we ought to be either taxing those they say tax the universities, but the way it works, thanks to the United States Constitution, is you can't, if you're going to tax the universities, you probably want to have to tax churches and other nonprofits as well, right? I don't think you can successfully single out one category there. But, you know, it sort of makes for good politics to say, well, the universities are not covering their fair share, and maybe they aren't. And maybe some of the hospitals aren't either. But, you know, I think people need to be a little careful about where they take this conversation, because it can go into some very unintended directions if they're not careful. You know, so I just thought it was kind of worth it. So there was a bill at the House, I think in the House and Senate, Massachusetts, you know, to basically regularize the idea of in lieu of tax payments. I mean, right now, City of Cambridge will separately negotiate in lieu of tax payments, agreements, pilot, they call it, payments in lieu of taxes with Harvard University, MIT, and some of the other area colleges within the bounds of Cambridge. And they pay a fraction of what they would if they were being taxes like regular taxable properties. But, you know, at least it's an acknowledgement of the fact that they use city services, and, you know, they also, you know, they're also contribute a lot to the city in terms of the, you know, providing jobs for people and whatever, but, you know, it's kind of tradition to do this. So they want to regularize that. And I just say, just be careful about that, because if you start promoting payment in lieu of taxes for one category, what are you going to do? Have require churches to do payments in lieu of taxes as well? And et cetera, et cetera. So I think just be a little bit careful. Another matter that came in at the very most recent city council meeting, which I believe was April 8th, there's a new petition. I hope I get the name right. It's like Ronayne et al. Petition, which I was a little confused by, but I got some clarification today. And just to put it in a bit of a nutshell, is that this is a residential petition that's not unlike one that Doug Brown introduced, a few years ago, that basically I think it's actually a good petition, you know, and I'm a little suspicious about a lot of zoning petitions, but it's a good petition because it wants to regularize and simplify the legality of what they call accessory dwelling units. I mean, some of those have been kind of normalized because of other initiatives over the last few years. But, like, for example, if you had a carriage house behind you, should you necessarily to turn that into a separate dwelling unit? Should you have to go seek variances and special permits, you know, up the yin yang in order to do something which most people would look at it and go, that's a very reasonable thing to do. Part of its intention is to make some of these things that most of us would consider reasonable, make them easier and a little bit less regulated that you can do it. It would also, and this is something people have talked about for a while now, it has a provision included in this one that would permit multifamily housing in all residential zones, or all zones, really. And I thought, well, okay, that's another thing that I think most of us consider to be, you know, there may be some nuances that deserve some special treatment, sure, but, and you certainly wouldn't want to, you know, have everybody turn every larger house in Western Cambridge into giant apartment buildings just because you can. I mean, there are some reasonable accommodations I think you can make to preserve at least some of the character of some of these neighborhoods. But I think just permitting, you know, somebody to operate a 2 or 3 family home out of a property in a place that says single family only is a very reasonable thing. People have been talking about it for a few years, and that's also part of this petition. Another thing which was really reminiscent of something I said when I was on this Envision Housing Working Group, which, as far as I'm concerned, was a bit of a disaster. But, you know, when people were promoting things like the affordable housing overlay, you know, that would allow, you know, dense heights and densities up to 3 and 4 times whatever the prevailing densities are in these neighborhoods, people would say, well, you know, right now you couldn't even build a building today that's been, you know, like my house, for example, is got a floor area ratio of like, I think, 1.12. That would not, you know, in a zone that where you would, your limit would be 0.75, it would not be permitted. So back then I suggested that maybe one good thing to do is just to allow, is to tweak the allowable FARs across the board so that things that are somewhat artificially low could be increased marginally to give more flexibility to homeowners and also even for builders if they buy one place, if they want to build something that's a little bit bigger. So I think a proposal would raise the floor area ratio as of right up to 1.0. So just a modest increase in density all across the board. Of course, I'm going to say that's a good idea because I certainly suggested it a few years ago myself, you know. So anyway, so keep it on your radar. That should be, you know, heading to an ordinance committee or planning board meeting near you soon, though I haven't yet seen it, whether it's been scheduled or not. Don't really know. Again, just sort of chunking through my list here. One other thing that was not, I guess it was part of a city press release. It was also in the news otherwise. You know, for years, I remember people saying we should have another bridge or bridges that cross the railroad tracks, you know, out around the Alewife part of town. The first I heard about this back when, you know, out in Cambridge Park Drive was considered the boonies. It was just to have a crossing that you could connect the Fresh Pond Shopping Center over to where Ridge Towers are. And then he said, well, if it was just a matter of building a bridge, you could just do that at modest cost. But in order to meet the requirements of the Americans with Disabilities Act, the price became very high and kind of impossible. Anyway, so now what came out is that there's some federal money has come our way, at least to do the designs and preliminary work to permit not only such a crossing over the Fitchburg Railroad tracks, but also part of the planning for a bit of a pedestrian bikeway that would actually run parallel to the tracks heading on its way. I don't know if it goes all the way up to Porter Square, but, you know, sort of a nice right of way that would run parallel to the tracks. Maybe with a little luck, even go through the old cattle pass up near Porter Square, where they used to actually have stockyards many, many years ago. But anyway, that was welcome money. It was some pretty serious money. I forget exactly what the sum was, but it was a good chunk of change that would actually allow for a very, very substantial, $2.4 million, which isn't big money, but just to cover some of the preliminary work. So I thought that was great. Now, in my view, and again, I'm not trying to dismiss the notion about cost here, because you need money to do good things. But in my worldview, there should be not only that crossing, between Fresh Pond Mall Shopping Center and Ridge Towers, but also west of there, there ought to be not one, but two crossings over the railroad tracks to connect the Alewife Quadrangle and the Alewife Triangle. And there also ought to be a pedestrian bridge over the creek up there, a little river, I guess we call it, to connect the Science Park area over to the created wetland area. These are things that would just make Cambridge so much better if they could only find a way to afford it, you know. So I just think we ought to keep a little light burning under all of those ideas, because I think it would be a good thing for all of us to have some of those things actually happen. And, you know, here in the last minute and a half, I'll just say one other thing, which is that after the presidential primaries I manage, I always request an updated registered voter database, as well as the voter history file of who actually voted in the election. So I got that, and they merged it with my, 38 different election results over the years. And my little test that I always do to sort of say, did I make any mistakes? My first test is I test to see how many people are there in Cambridge who have not missed a single citywide election since I started keeping track of this, which is really coincides with when there was a unified state database for doing this, which was 1997. So that's a good long ways now. That's like 27 years. So when I first started doing that, there was like a few hundred, and then it got smaller and smaller and smaller. People move away, see people pass away. And so I just wanted to say here in the latest one, we're down to I call them the super voters. There are just 77 of us, and I know about half of them. So anyway, on that note, I think I'll sort of wind it down here now. And pay attention to what's on the calendars, and I'll be back in a couple of weeks here on Cambridge Inside Out.